All right, today is March 1st, 2017. This is an interview with Bethany Plimers. We are here at Union South. These interviews are being done with Academic Staff Excellence Award winners as part of the Academic Staff Institute. And my name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. Bethany, to help with the sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Bethany Plimers, P-L-U-Y-M-E-R-S.
Thank you. Bethany, I'm going to get it just a little closer to you.
Okay.
It's picking us up just fine. Yeah. I just may have to speak up a little bit to make sure the questions get heard.
We can move a little closer.
So I gave you a list of questions, and we're going to go right from the top. The first is a two-part question, so I'll just ask the first part initially. So what brought you to UW-Madison?
Great deliberation. We were living in the St. Louis area, and our kids were little, and we wanted to live in a progressive community and raise our kids somewhere that there was a premium placed on public and higher education. And my husband had visited here, and he said, let's move to Madison. And I said, great idea. And he said, do you want to see it? And I said, sure. And we spent about an afternoon here and thought, where do we sign up? Obviously, UW-Madison has a great reputation as a flagship research university, and I had been for 15 years at Washington University in St. Louis and wanted to stay in higher ed, and we're really looking for a good place to raise our children. And I stumbled on the assistant dean position at the law school, and while I'd been at a medical school all these years, it was a skill fit. And so I applied and I was interviewed and they hired me.
Mm-hmm. So since you mentioned your previous work, one of the questions that I sent to you was the difference between, or maybe I didn't.
You did?
The difference between working in law and working in medicine. So I wonder if you'd elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, so I actually started out in the equivalent there of the Research and Sponsored Programs Office and was asked to interview for a job in pediatric oncology. I was the division administrator there, and there was a lot of basic science research as well as clinical research as well as patient care. And then I moved to biochemistry and molecular biophysics. So a lot of wet lab experience, working with a lot of doctors and a lot of scientists. And so I did get teased a little bit when I took this position of moving from medicine to going to turn lawyers out at the nest, right? And realized it did not at all have an appreciation what one can do with legal education, how narrow my view was of the law. And I have never been in a job as long as I've been in this one. And a lot of it is to do with how proud I am of what we do at the law school. The different kinds of careers you can have and for which a law degree is useful, public service. But anyway, the question you asked, difference between medicine and lawyers, it's pretty different, because in medicine it's sort of it's a very grant-driven enterprise, and law school until recently hasn't been at all. Wet laboratory research and patient care require that folks be there all the time, and the law faculty are traveling a lot, doing research in other locations. So it is a very different discipline, but it was a real education for me after 15 years in medicine to see what one can do with a law degree. Things that get me out of bed in the morning, Professor Keith Finley's Innocence Project work, Professor Altashero's bioethics work. We have a lot of clinical programs, which people don't fully appreciate. You think clinical, you think medicine, right? So we're basically sort of practicing, and by we, I mean they, I'm not a lawyer, in the community, landlord-tenant law, immigration law, legal aid to institutionalized persons. They go into the prisons and work with the prisoners with regard to their rights. A lot of parental, you don't think about that, right? You're in prison, what happens to your parental rights? Restoration project, reentry project, some of which have been discontinued due to a lot of demand or funding cuts and things like that. But it's really kind of exciting what we're doing. And you think about legal research, right? You kind of go, what is that? And I had somebody in just this morning talking about a grant that they're going to be proposing that is looking at, you know, eviction numbers and the demographics just here in Dane County of where that's happening, you know, racial component, economic component, educational components, things like that. So a lot of what we do at the law school is much more interdisciplinary than you might imagine. We have folks teaching in legal studies, sociology, political science. Our Center for Patient Partnerships is an interdisciplinary center with nursing, medicine, pharmacy, and social work. It's really different, but it's similar in that there are so many ways to specialize, so many different kinds of research, and so much application to the daily lives of people. And that's kind of exciting. I mean, I could do what I do anywhere, right? At the Widget Factory. I do HR, finance, oversee IT and facilities, and I could do this anywhere, but I'm really proud to do it here.
Mm-hmm. So Bethany, the next question was, you know, what led to your work or research interest? So I'll frame it in a sense of, you talked about you can do your work anywhere, mm-hmm. but why do that? Why are you interested in doing that work at all?
Well, my career has been a little bit of a happy accident. My bosses and husband would disagree, but, you know, being asked to go look at something that I ended up being really interested and passionate about. So how did I end up doing this? To me, administration and the job I have at the law school is the best administrative job on campus, I think. We're small, we're centralized, and I get to do a lot of things. So I get to manage the budget, but understand the human resource impacts and the other way around. I get to manage the built environment, which very much affects how people can do their jobs. So I guess what I like best about it are two things. One, the ability to really positively impact people's lives. And two, every day is a big algebraic equation. I have a math degree in addition to a business degree and a teaching certificate. And it's problem solving all day, every day, but with the human element, without which I don't think I'd enjoy it nearly as much. If I was singularly focused on finance, for instance, it would be fun and challenging, but not nearly as fun as it is when you interject the human element mm-hmm. into it. And I've enjoyed almost every step of it mm-hmm. along the way. It's not without its challenges.
Mm-hmm. I think you've sort of answered this, but these next two questions coming up are going to be sort of directly asking. I mean, you just said that every day is an algebraic equation, but how do you describe what you do when people ask?
Well, I usually say I push paper around at the law school, and then people laugh and ask more questions. But I just had to write a bio for a play that I'm going to be in shortly, and what I said for that was that I'm basically CFO, HR director, facilities manager, and I pretend to oversee the information technology enterprise. Like a lot of people, describing a regular day is pretty difficult to do, right? Just today, for instance, I talked to someone about a really difficult meeting that they had and strategized about what the next meeting should look like, talked with someone else about something they're struggling with and how we might restructure to make it less friction-filled, had a meeting with the library and a faculty member to figure out how we might finance some databases that he needs and data sets that he needs to do his research and interject more experiential learning into the curriculum of his courses. After this, I'm going to a graduate programs meeting to figure out how we can negotiate the next year's contract with a university in China who sends students here. So, and again, the beauty part is I've got a foot in both. You know, our human resources are 75% of our budget. And since I'm responsible for both, I just feel like I can make much better recommendations about how to solve problems. But a typical day doesn't really exist. But I'm sure that doesn't make me special.
So how does one learn, or what sort of training does one get to do what you do?
Well, my training is consisted primarily of, in the early days, there's your desk, good luck with that. And as I got promoted along, there's your office, good luck with that. I think academia in particular, you'll find that happens because even coming from a private institution, you're always trying to do more with less. And I really am excited about particularly the human resources community of practice that's been started up, where we're actually trying to develop a competencies cohort for HR professionals. So there actually would be some formal training, less in nuts and bolts, and more about how to conduct yourself and what kinds of soft skills are needed to be successful. My training was having a number of good mentors along the way, and quite frankly, here at the University of Wisconsin, which was different from the private institution I came from, I find the central offices want to help you succeed. So if you don't know what to do, the best training is being well-resourced. If you don't know what to do, figure out who to call and say, here's the problem I'm trying to solve. Will you help me solve it? And I found in large part in the budget office and the human resources offices that they want to partner with you and do that. Mm-hmm. So the training has been pretty independent, but there are resources available. You just have to figure out what they are.
You talked about good mentors along the way. I wonder if you have examples of good mentors here and you'd be willing to explain why they are.
Well, absolutely. Both of my deans, and they, in different ways, because they've got very different styles, had very different styles, you know, were examples of how to have your people's back, right? One of the cardinal rules is never take any credit and always take the heat, right? And seeing people in leadership do that. And then colleagues. Steve Lund is someone who comes to mind, who is a mentor for a lot of HR people on campus. And sort of being willing to appropriately break the rules, right? Not hide behind rules and use the long arm of the law to not help someone, right? Because what I love about this job is its service, right? It's a safety net. You know, I'm not the reason the university, you know, what I do is not the reason the university is here. The university is here because of students and faculty, and I'm here to take care of them and make their lives easier, which is particularly important at an institution that is so under-resourced. And just seeing other people behave in that same way has been inspiring.
Thank you. So the next question is about technology and how technology has changed your work.
You know, I saw the question, and I've been at this a long time, so I'm sure it has changed my work, but I couldn't think of specific examples how. It feels like it's always been there. How it's probably changed my work is I've overseen the technology, the IT departments in my various jobs for a really long time, and it's not an area I'm particularly proficient in, right? Which, poor IT director who has to report to me, right? So actually how it's changed my work is having to learn more than I otherwise might have to oversee the effort and understand the difference between what we'd really like to have, what we really need, and also not to be penny wise and pound foolish, right? With cybersecurity issues and things of that nature. But in terms of my work, I just feel like the technology's always been there, but that can't possibly be true because I've been at this for about 30 years.
Yeah, I've been asking people specifically about the use of electronic mail, so email as opposed to phone or memos.
Right. When my very first job was a lot of phone, that is true, but that didn't last very long. And as soon as I went to pediatrics for the first real sort of administrator type position would have been 1987, and we had pretty robust email. I do feel that it has changed expectations in that, you know, you'll be in the hallway and someone will say, did you get my email of 10 minutes ago, right? So back in the days of phone and memos, I don't think there was this heightened expectation of instantaneous response. Good thing, bad thing? Probably a little of both, right? We're more responsive. Things happen faster. Sometimes you're not allowed adequate time to be as thoughtful as you might be because the expectation is, you know, you're on vacation. You're going to be reading your email and you're going to be responding. But I guess that's become so second nature that even reading that question, I didn't think to myself, oh yeah, gosh, technology's really changed the way I do my work. It's just such an embedded piece of it. Mm-hmm. But I think for sure, you know, for someone who gets at least 100 email a day, I do think it contributes to the sender sometimes, myself included, just shooting off an email rather than, you know, if you have to pick up the phone or walk down to somebody's office, you're going to be much more thoughtful about your time and their time. Mm-hmm. Just shooting an email when you're, you know, sitting waiting to have your haircut or something is an interaction you would embark on now that you wouldn't have when you were limited to phone and no cell phone, right? And or a paper memo. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes we create work that we didn't need to because we have such ready access to technology. Mm-hmm. But the flip side, right, the good and the bad and the ugly, is we may be much more efficient and effective as a result. Mm-hmm. It's a tough one to sort out.
Right. One of the people I talked to today also noted something I hadn't really thought about because I came of age during, you know, email and internet. I came of age before it, but it's been in my life, most of my professional life, is the idea of the wireless aspect of it now. So yes, you can send an email while you're getting your haircut, where, you know, even as little as maybe 10, 12 years ago, you couldn't necessarily do that.
True, true. You can maybe do stuff from home, but it required the modem that made all the noise, right? Mm-hmm. That's a really good point. But
and
it's
that
just so
also
second
increases
nature.
Expectations, too.
Absolutely.
Because people know that now, if they send you an email, I could answer it here, or I could answer it at my desk, or I could answer it at home, or I could answer it when I'm on vacation.
And you have to be really careful. I mean, really try to signal to my team that, because I'm not quite adept enough to know how to set the time, which probably isn't that hard to figure out, but I don't do, they shouldn't be even looking at it on the weekends. It's just not necessary. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we're not doing neurosurgery here.
Right. So the other part of administration, or another part of administration, is just what you alluded to, supervising people. Was your training for how to be a supervisor the same as the training that you alluded to for everything else?
A little bit. I remember interviewing for it was the division administrator of the Division of Pediatric Hematology and Oncology. And I was 25, and I'd be supervising people. I had no supervisory experience. And the assistant business manager, whose job I eventually got when she got promoted, asked me about my supervisory experience. And I said, I didn't have any direct supervisory experience, but I had taught school, and did she think that that would be transferable? And she worked really hard to contain her laughter, but she did laugh and said, yes, she thought that would be transferable. So, no formal training. Certainly have tried to do professional development in that area over the years. It's something I enjoy, and I think it's something I'm fairly good at. And of course, it's easier when you hire the right people for the position, right? And when you make the hire often. You know, sometimes you come into a situation and you have folks who are used to someone else, a different way of doing things. But I think the real important thing about supervising is recognizing people's strengths and talents and maximizing those. I used to have a discussion with a faculty member who's since passed away, who was associate dean, and we talk about the continuum of personnel management, we called it back in the day, and that is one extreme being a very rigid sense of structure, right, and trying to plug people into your round holes. And the other end being almost letting people tell you, here's what I want to do, let me do that. And we decided in our infinite wisdom that it was somewhere left of center, right, in terms of, yeah, you ought to have a structure and you ought to have roles established and positions established, but you really ought to maximize the skills and abilities of individuals. And you don't always know what they are until they've been doing the job a while. And that piece is kind of fun. So every time you hire someone new, I have a team of 5 people that work with me, for me. And anytime anybody leaves, and we try to do this throughout the law school, to really think about, okay, how do we redistribute responsibilities to really make the best use, the highest and best use, as my dean would say, of the folks here? And are there opportunities for growth and professional development as we think about redistributing things and hiring new folks? And I have a relatively new team, so we just rounded the last first anniversary of everyone but me and my HR managers. That's been really, really fun. Some of the positions are new, some are retirements. Sounds like a lot of turnover. It really wasn't, but that's pretty fun.
Mm-hmm. Have you been or were you involved in academic staff governance or groups?
You know, not as much as I would have liked, and this is almost embarrassing. As limited staff for many years, I didn't think I could. I didn't think I was eligible, but I do have an academic staff backup, and I think limited folks, even who don't have academic staff backup, are eligible. I do get tapped a lot for campus committees, and so the remaining time is pretty limited. I have expressed interest and have been pretty active in supporting our CASI committee as an ex officio member and bringing to them things that they ought to be plugged into and answering their questions about what sometimes feels like the Byzantine, you know, inner clock workings of the university. But I think the governance of this campus is fascinating. I've never seen anything like it. I've been at 3 other institutions. One was private, so there was very little of that. One was a public corporation, which had gone from being part of the state, breaking away from the state, and then actually creating for themselves more onerous rules than what they had when they worked for the state. So that was interesting. And so this was very different environment. Now, I've been here off and on. I had a brief break of a year and a half since 1999. And I think it is very special and unique, even amongst other large publics. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool to see the impact an individual can have on the environment. Now, there's the flip side of that, and sometimes people do feel powerless. I'm not saying it's all rainbows and unicorns, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
I think we have about 10 more minutes. I want to make sure I get a couple of things that I would like asked.
Sure.
The specific event that happened sort of the historical global event that happened during your time on campus was September 11th, 9/11, 2001. So I'm wondering if you're willing to talk about that both as a person and then also as a campus citizen.
Well, I wasn't here when that happened. I came in July of 1999. I was here for a year and a half. I got recruited away, and I went to Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. I was there a year and a half, and then they asked me back, and I came back. So I was out there when that happened. But that was actually, this is a little corny, but that was actually one of the events that made me realize I didn't want to be there and I wanted to be here. One of our faculty members here had a brother in one of the towers who died, and I was in contact with folks here the whole time I was gone, and you know, they're telling me stories about, you know, he just hopped in the, you know, couldn't get a flight, of course, so he got in his car and just drove out there. And it was a clarifying moment for me in terms of where we really wanted to be. And it's interesting, the clarity of just being away gives you about what you were doing and what might be possible if you went back. And so I've had the privilege of being able to do that. But it was interesting being out there and still having connections to here and knowing how many people here were affected by that. Mm-hmm. It was pretty poignant for everybody, right?
You talk about how it made you want to come back, and I think how you phrased it is sort of made you think about what you want to do when you came back. So do you have a for example of how it changed your thinking about how you approached?
I don't know if I have a specific example, but the general sort of philosophical shift was, I mean, when I came here, there had only been someone in my position for about a year and a half, and he found the job pretty tough, and he focused on the things he felt he could control, and that was why. That's one of the reasons technology isn't as palpable to me as a big shift, because he confronted all of that. Like, he got the law school wired and got desktops. This would have been 1996, 7, 8 on all of the offices and all that sort of thing. And there were a couple of things he just didn't think he could get at because of some of the staffing issues, which when I came were pretty difficult. And I guess the philosophical psychological shift was, after an event like that, you just sort of realize these are not insurmountable problems, right? These are just bureaucratic differences in style, personality, cultural, historical, whatever. And the right approach, I mean, I think on this campus it would be fair to say that incremental change is really how we do things here, given the governance structure and how mammoth the place is, that change was really possible. I mean, if something like this could happen, it just sort of dwarfed any things that felt like challenges, made them, so I guess if there was any lesson to be learned, I wouldn't say ever there was a bright side to that, but it's like any time, unfortunately, you lose someone, right? It just sharpens your perspective about what's really important and what's possible.
I wonder if you'd tell the story behind receiving the Academic Staff Excellence Award.
Apparently, a number of folks, including my dean and some close colleagues and someone who had worked for me for a really long time, had done this, I'm not exactly sure how many times in a row, and I had no idea until they told me I had won, and then they gave me the packet and I got to read the letters, which I now say anytime we nominate someone, whether they win or not, give them the packet. Because those, I'm going to start getting choked up right now, reading those letters. And, well, one, it's ridiculous. I mean, there are so many people contributing on this campus. It was ridiculous. This wasn't about me. It was about other people being very generous and gracious. But it was certainly fabulous and wonderful to know that I have had a positive impact on the lives of other people throughout my career here. And I'm not speechless very often, but that left me speechless. It was really something. Mm-hmm. It was really something.
Did you attend the reception?
I did.
What are your memories of that?
It was lovely. I had written, you know, some remarks, which I'm still really happy about, which were basically a long list of thank yous. And I think a little funny, if I do say so myself. But I was so engrossed in the remarks. My former dean who'd written, so my current dean and my former dean wrote a letter. A faculty member who was the senior associate dean when I came back from Portland. Another colleague, and then a guy who works for me wrote the letters, and all of them came except my current dean. She just had a conflict. But anyway, my former dean had winters in Florida, and he came back, I think, made arrangements to make sure he was back for that. But he wasn't there when it started. I didn't even realize he was there. I was looking right at him while I was talking, and I didn't even realize he was there until afterwards. So it was really like another dimension. I mean, and to hear the chancellor saying nice things about you, mm-hmm. is kind of a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. You know, my daughter came. These things are really meaningful to people. We try to nominate with regularity because there are ways to recognize people on campus. I'm usually on the end of writing a letter for somebody, and I was dumbfounded. I was absolutely flabbergasted and dumbfounded.
One more thing I think we have time for. Yeah, we have a couple minutes. It's the legacy question. I mean, I don't know when you're retiring, but I don't know if anybody will ever do an oral history with you again. So at this point in your life, what would you like to be remembered for, and is it the same as that you want to be remembered for?
I'm sorry.
So what do you feel you will be remembered for?
Oh.
And is that the same as what you really would like to be remembered for?
Well, gosh, I hope so. I hope they're the same. And what I'd really like to be remembered for was, you know, often administration is not always characterized in a particularly bright way, happy way. I would like to be remembered as someone who was there and whose sole mission was to forward the institution by making it easier for the real work to get done, the teaching, the research, the service. And somebody who, you know, in at least small ways or incremental ways, made the lives of our employees better. You know, made sure promotions happened when they should, made sure people didn't get missed when raises were being administered, had an open door and listened, even if nothing could be done, but would listen. Sometimes that's all people want, is someone to listen to them. So, I mean, I'm hoping I'll just be remembered as somebody who did good while I was here and helped move the place forward. And the best part of my job is positively affecting the lives of the employees. Because my job, I mean, I'm very interested in students, but my day-to-day interaction is with our faculty and our staff. And if in some small way I made it easier for them to do what they're here for or made their lives better, I'd be a happy camper.
That's a nice way to end. So, Bethany, thank you very much. This concludes the interview with Bethany Plimers.
Thank you.